So I think that there is still a fundamental disagreement on you know, some of the causes of URI and some of the problems we have in the market right now. And I would boil that down to, is it something that can be solved with operational fixes? Was it just an operational problem? And I don't say just to diminish it, but was it largely an operational problem? Or was it this greater problem of we simply don't have enough generation online to meet load?
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Transmission. Today's episode is with Caitlin Smith, Vice President of Policy and Corporate Communications at Jupiter Power. The conversation covers policy in ERCOT, how decisions are made, and what it means for battery energy storage. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And with that, let's jump in.
Hello, Caitlin.
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We've been pretty excited about this one. So thanks for driving all the way, actually being driven
being
all
driven.
The way from Euston.
In an electric car.
So Caitlin, if you listen to this, so Caitlin joins us from Jupiter Power. In a minute, I'm going to ask you, Caitlin, a bit about your background and a bit about Jupiter Power. But in a nutshell, Jupiter Power is the biggest owner of storage in ERCOT in Texas. Many gigawatts of things all over the place. Caitlin is an expert, well, beyond an expert in ERCOT policy, and is heavily involved in lots of the mechanics of how decisions get made. And so we thought we'd get Caitlin on and ask her for some of the ins and outs about policy in ERCOT. What are some of the hot potatoes? And we're going to dive into some of them in detail. But Caitlin, first, do you want to just talk about who you are and what you did before Jupiter Power?
Sure. So thanks for that great intro. I think that is, you know, if I can claim that to be correct, I will. I've been working, as you said, in ERCOT, kind of stakeholder policy and market design, maybe about 11 years. I started in this area with what's called the market monitor to ERCOT. The joke I make a lot is before URI, it used to take me kind of 10 minutes to explain what the market monitor was and what ERCOT was and what the function was. And I think now, since URI, a lot of people in Texas know. So that's an advisory role on market design, as well as kind of, you know, looking for and investigating potential market manipulation in ERCOT. I did that for a couple of years. And since then, I've been in kind of various stakeholder roles, a lot of representing generation in kind of ERCOT market design and policy. During URI, I was working in a consulting role. And so I got a tremendous education then, because just the amount of clients we had in different segments. So generators, you know, financial, just trading parties, large load customers, and we had some municipal owned utilities as well. Just the amount of questions and all these unprecedented situations, I really learned a lot. The last 2.5 years, I have been with Jupiter Power, which is a developer and owner operator of utility scale standalone battery energy storage. As you said, if not the largest, one of the largest fleets in ERCOT, 775 megawatt hours in operations, another 200 megawatt hours in construction in ERCOT. So that's over a gig that is online or will be online this year. And then a development pipeline across the country, more in ERCOT, but in other ISOs as well. And I think that development pipeline is about 11 gigs.
You've just taken all of my stats. I was going to say some stats about Jupiter Power, but you've just done it all for me. But you guys are big in batteries. To put this into perspective, one of the biggest public listed funds in Europe that owns battery assets is about the same size, kind of a gigawatt-ish under management.
Okay.
And lots more coming. So huge base of assets, lots of things to get right, and lots of assets to go and manage, trade, and be close to the market for. How many people are involved? How big is this company?
I think about 90. So Jupiter Power was founded in 2017. That's sort of, I say, the friends in a coffee shop phase. First influx of private equity backing in 19, and that was NCAP. We went through a sale process in late 22. We are now backed by BlackRock. So we're kind of in, I would say, phase three of the company. And so we've been growing and growing quickly. We have about 90 people. We are very proud of, as you mentioned, you know, that's a lot of energy storage megawatts to kind of own, operate, trade around as a fleet. We think we are kind of one of the first to have a big fleet of storage in ERCOT and be really operating that as optimizing the portfolio and not just one asset. So we are building out our trading team. We have a really great head of trading. So we have a trading team in Houston, some really great settlement folks. You know, everyone who you think would be in Houston with that background is in Houston. We are headquartered here in Austin, and our CEO and legal and some of our corporate functions are here. And then we have a very large development team, mostly in Chicago. And that's, you know, are really great, like young entrepreneurs who are looking at all these opportunities across the country. So I think what makes us different is having that strong development arm and then the strong, you know, asset management and trading arms as well.
One of the things that strikes me is you've gone down a vertically integrated route. So you do the power trading and optimization in-house. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's one of the business models that's starting to emerge in ERCOT and California, various places, is the third-party optimizer route. Mm-hmm. How are you guys thinking about that? Of course, you guys have come to the conclusion that it's best to do that in-house. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that?
You know, I think that that is ingrained in how we started the company. You know, we have intellectual property ourselves and the dispatch optimization software and forecasting that we do in-house. And we look at third-party, you know, tools to kind of benchmark. But I think that that was part of our business model to start with, right? It was this idea of here's this technology and here's a unique way to dispatch it. I think that all of that is sort of ingrained in the origins of Jupiter.
And so coming up to a gigawatt in Texas, mm-hmm. and where else are you guys developing and building assets?
I think every market in North America, CAISO and MISO are kind of near term after ERCOT. And then when we're looking, you know, 4 to 6 years out, we do get very heavy into the Northeast, into PJM, New York ISO, and New England as well.
And all backed by BlackRock?
Yes.
Okay. Just go, go, go then.
Go, go, go.
So in a previous episode, and we discussed it before we went live in quite some detail, we had Brant on to talk about what goes on in the control room at ERCOT. Mm-hmm. That was extremely well received, and we had lots of questions come in from it. And so this time, we're going to go down a different angle, which is talking about policy at ERCOT and what our listeners need to know from an energy storage perspective. So could you give an overview of how, and I know there's a very complicated diagram of this, which I've seen.
Should we draw it? Which diagram? Is there a good diagram?
So I'm interested in how decisions get made at ERCOT and to do with ERCOT. Yeah. So
okay.
Say we think, we get together and we think, oh, actually, this rule is meaning that batteries won't get built because they're unfairly excluded from X, or this rule unfairly, I don't know, reduces incentive to build gas plant here, or whatever the argument is. And so we want to discuss that. How do we do that?
There's a lot of things happening in different places, which I'm sure you know. So ERCOT, and this became a criticism, but I don't think it's necessarily so. ERCOT is not under FERC. So ERCOT is sort of a standalone market in Texas. Because it is contained in Texas, it is under state law.
So not FERC, which is the
Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, right? And then NERC is a corporation, I think, even though it's a nonprofit, it has corporation. So FERC is a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So ERCOT is not under FERC, but we're self-contained in Texas, so we're under state law. So you have ERCOT, which is quasi-governmental and a nonprofit that is member-based nonprofit. It is under jurisdiction of the Public Utility Commission, which is a state agency in Texas. The commissioners at the Public Utility Commission are appointed by the governor, so they're not elected. They are appointed by the governor.
How many of them are there?
There are five. Pre-URI, there were three, and now you have five. The purpose of making it more than three is, if you only have three, two cannot talk to each other alone, because then you are violating the Open Meetings Act. And because two would be a quorum out of three. So during URI, two cannot talk to each other unless they called an open meeting and gave public notice and all of that. So commissioners were not able to speak to each other during that emergency. And so that is why it is now five, because now two can speak to each other because three is a quorum. And so the public utility commissioners are appointed by the governor. The public utility commission is under state law. State law is made by the Texas state legislature, which is bicameral. There's a House and a Senate, and each has a committee that kind of has jurisdiction over the public utility commission. On the House side, it's state affairs. On the Senate side, it is business and commerce. I go into this level of detail just to say the Senate in Texas is led by the lieutenant governor. And so you have both the governor and the lieutenant governor kind of with some amount of ownership over what happens, which can, you know, you can get some interesting political viewpoints over that, which I think is probably good, right? Because you get sort of everybody to the highest level of state government interested in what's happening at ERCOT.
So just to get that clear, So then there's five, what words did you describe them? The five humans at the top of the...
Public utility commissioners?
Yeah, commissioners, five commissioners. And do they sit right at the top and are they on the board of ERCOT?
Two of them are on the board of ERCOT.
Only two?
Only two. But the board reports to the utility commission.
Okay.
And I believe... I'd have to check. They might be ex officio members, so not true voting members.
Yeah, okay.
So at ERCOT, when you're talking about ERCOT rules, you know, they are not really making policy, right? So you would say, so for example, during URI, we were in state legislative session. So we got legislation, which turns into laws, that has to be implemented through PUC administrative rules. And then that gets implemented through ERCOT protocols. You can also have ERCOT protocols that go kind of bottom up that are ideas from ERCOT staff or from stakeholders. And there's always been sort of a robust stakeholder process there. And that is done, I'm a big fan of that. That's done sort of through compromise, right? It's each segment. So segment meaning, you know, different participation in the market. So you have, you know, retailers, residential load, generators, investor-owned utilities, municipally owned utilities, cooperatives, gets the same amount of representation. And they kind of discuss things. So they have that representation kind of represents their commercial viewpoint, but they also have the expertise, right? These are the people who operate the wires or who operate the generators. And so you get a good compromise there. Now those rules kind of the top of ERCOT, as you alluded, is a board that has changed since URI as well. And that used to be a stakeholder board or kind of a half and half, a stakeholder board and half independent board. And now it's a fully independent board.
So there's been a lot of change.
Need a diagram.
Yeah.
This podcast.
We didn't even go down to the bottom bit, which is, the bottom-up decision-making is the diagram that I've seen, which looks incredibly busy.
Is it the working groups?
Yeah, the working groups and the subcommittees. It's a lot for 1A4 page. But a lot's changed since URI.
Yeah.
And so is it finished now? So URI happened and all the changes happened and is that it?
We do see these cyclical conversations, right? So even if we were to say right now, yes, PCM or no PCM. I don't think anyone imagines that's the end of resource adequacy discussions, right? And I just think the nature of the market, I know you said it was really complicated for being a free market, but it has to be because you have wind, solar, batteries, you know, all these technology types, all these different load customers.
That was just to be clear, right? I was not a diss.
I'm just saying this is why you can't like rubber stamp it. I always say it's not set it and forget it, because if you set it and forget it, that is when you would have a catastrophe because things are going to continue to change.
But just coming back, you mentioned something there. So we crossed into resource adequacy for a second. You said PCM, and for our listeners, it's probably worth saying what that is.
It is a construct that we have come up with since Winter Storm URI. We sort of went on a journey with resource adequacy, which is kind of the, you know, don't drink when we say it because you'll be on your, you know, fourth American pint and third British pint. We started with a proposal that was a load serving entity obligation, which was sort of a bilateral capacity market. And what I mean by that is a capacity market as opposed to an energy market is you buy the capacity ahead of time. You kind of pay it to exist, you know, to oversimplify, right? It's not pay for performance, it's pay to exist. So we were looking at this mechanism wherein each load would have to sort of contract for enough capacity to serve its load plus a little bit. We contracted, we being the PUC, who's not me, but, you know, collectively stakeholders, everybody interested in ERCOT, we had a study done by E3 to evaluate, you know, traditional capacity market, the LLC obligation, what would happen if we stayed with the energy-only market, various things. And what came out of that was a recommendation for something called the performance credit mechanism. This is a pretty new construct as I understand it. I think we thought entirely new, but I believe there might be some markets that do something similar. So you would have a set amount of performance hours, and then you would kind of retroactively look at those hours, and the generators that performed then would get paid some credit amount for that performance.
So are we talking about times of system stress?
We would find some way of defining the 30, I think was the number that was talked about, but I think maybe the number even wouldn't be set in stone. You would pick ahead of time some amount of hours and some way of defining what are the highest stress times. It could be, you know, pure highest amount of load or highest amount of net load, which means load that's not served by wind or solar, or, you know, highest amount of thermal outages, anything like that. You would have it predefined and you'd have the numbers preset. And then after the year, you would go back and look at those hours and identify who performed.
So
why are you laughing?
Well, we already did this, right, in Great Britain.
You did this.
We had this thing called the Triad. It wasn't really called the Triad. It was called Tenuos. And I'm not going to go into the details of why it was called that. But we created it. Mm-hmm. We did it, and then we've just taken it away, and it's taken 15 years probably to go around that cycle. And okay. So we had 3 half-hour periods, and it was it was the highest load period.
Mm-hmm.
And you could
just
always
highest pure load, not
half-hour
load.
Period. Okay. Highest, so 3 wow. half hours, and the payments were huge. They were like £50,000-£60,000 a megawatt, depending on where you were.
Okay.
So you could if you were dispatched, if you're a gas unit or you were even DSR, you get paid a fortune for it. And then you recover the cost from everybody. You kind of democratize the cost. The reason why I'm laughing, though, is because, and another funny thing about the triads is there was always one, they always used to say in the control room in National Grid, it was always the third Wednesday after Christmas. And it was, the triads were always between 4 and 7. And there was usually one at 5:30. And go on.
Could you have an hour and a half in a row?
That no, they have the to be 10 days apart.
So I think that's something that we would have up for discussion, too. I think some of the proposals would be, you know, it was not the 30 highest of the year, but, you know, the 1 or 2 every month.
Well, 30 sounds a lot more sensible. 3 is a bit crazy because you have so many people that do this thing called hunting triads. So you would run a unit just to try and find that load. But then you could, the margins got so tight that you could move the triad because there are so many units trying to move it.
Well, so in Texas, we have 4CP, which I think Brant did discuss, which is the transmission costs are allocated based on the 4 highest intervals.
I like it because it's like playing poker. It's like high stakes stuff. But yeah, we just got rid of it because it all became a bit too costly and created behavior that we didn't really want. But it's funny how, you know, you can design this thing. And I say we, Great Britain, I'm not there anymore. But I saw it come and saw it go, and that's why I was smiling. Let's talk about some of the policy work that you've worked on to set the scene before we go down some rabbit holes. Okay. So
before we go do N-1 contingencies.
Before we do N-1 contingencies. If you're listening to this, so Caitlin was taking the mic out of our episode about ERCOT's control room because we went into some detail about some aspects. And we're not going to go into that level of detail today on.
And this is where all the listeners will drop off.
This is where all the listeners, they're going to say, where's the N-1? Where's the N-1? Okay, Caitlin, what sort of things have you been involved in with ERCOT over the years? Policy changes, frameworks, decisions, you know, can you talk about some of those?
Sure. And I might need you to kind of help me narrow it down. So when I joined the Independent Market Monitor, we were having sort of similar capacity market conversations. I think one of the things that has surprised me post Uri or even during Uri is how many things do stay the same. I think a lot of the policy, you know, for all the unprecedented situations we're in with that event and load growth and the kind of changing resource mix we've seen since Uri, I think some of the policy discussions have stayed sort of the same. It's sort of cyclical. And so we've been talking about, you know, should we go to a capacity market? Do we have a resource adequacy problem for 12 years, at least since 2011? And so I was in some of those beginning discussions when we were talking about capacity markets then. And I would say that's kind of the overarching thing that continually reoccurs. You know, so ORDC, we've talked about real-time co-optimization. You know, we've now in the last couple of years talked about load-serving entity obligations and the performance credit mechanism. So it kind of on the market side, it sort of always revolves and goes back to that resource adequacy conversation.
Okay, so one of the things we've discussed is that there are a lot of camps who have interests, mm-hmm. who are expressing influence on ERC or at in the state of Texas, mm-hmm. and lots of competing interests and proposed solutions to the same sort of problem. Mm-hmm. And have you noticed over the last 10 years or so a change in stance or a lens which people are using to look at these problems? Is Texas and ERCOT as a whole a, you know, radically pro-renewables world now?
Yeah. I mean,
if you go on Twitter, you can see every single side and get lost in it. So how has that changed?
You know, on the resource adequacy conversations, I think stances have probably largely stayed the same. You know,
resource
adequacy.
Let's go from the top, yeah.
Is this my N-1 contingency?
No. Oh, we're going to keep going back there.
So resource adequacy is this concept of, you know, exactly what it sounds like. Do you have enough resources? And so I think that there is still a fundamental disagreement on you know, some of the causes of Uri and some of the problems we have in the market right now. And I would boil that down to, is it something that can be solved with operational fixes? Was it just an operational problem? And I don't say just to diminish it, but was it largely an operational problem? Or was it this greater problem of we simply don't have enough generation online to meet load? I personally would say it was more of a operational issue, but we have seen this kind of rebuttal of we don't have enough generation to meet load for a long time. Particularly thermal generation, because that argument is coming from thermal resources who have found that with the influx of renewable resources, they can no longer maybe make the investment case to build as many thermal resources as they did in the past. So there is this concern that maybe we don't have enough thermal resources to meet the needs of customers.
And when you say thermal, we're talking about combustion.
You know, I think maybe we should say dispatchable.
Dispatchable.
But dispatchable, I would want to put batteries in there. But I think you would be talking about gas, coal, and nuclear, I think, as well, in what you would call traditionally thermal. At least I would be in Texas.
Okay, so we've done resource adequacy.
We've done resource adequacy.
But the reason why that was interesting, the reason why that was interesting was, I was asking you how have things changed? So
yes.
So on the whole, when you go, if you're going to a dinner party and all aspects and interests that have influence at ERCOT or within ERCOT were there, has the feeling of the dinner party changed over the last 10 years? The menu's the same, probably. But
I think the menu's different.
The menu's different. Let's do that.
Well, the resource mix is different, mm-hmm. obviously. And I think the most notable thing, you know, probably even more so, I would say, than the influx of renewables is the change in load characteristics. So it's not just a change in who you have supplying, but now you have a change in who's consuming. You know, I think the majority of what I'm talking about is data centers, but, you know, you could potentially have hydrogen, AI. So you have load that is consuming a lot more electricity and also consuming it in a different way, right? You know, a data center doesn't need or use electricity the way you or I do with babies at home or the way a hospital does. It's totally different. They have
unless it powers Disney Plus, in which case, let's keep that thing on.
That's very true. So, you know, they can ramp down quickly because of their technology and, you know, at certain times, right? Because they, unless it's Disney Plus, they might not need to be online the way, you know, the baby houses or the hospitals need to be online. I would say the biggest thing that has changed is some people's attitudes towards renewables. And I would say the large load customers that you have in Texas, which I think are traditionally, you know, oil and gas supply side guys, I think have really started to be more renewable friendly. And I think you can see that reflected a little bit in policy, but also in just the market, right? You have these in Texas, whether you think maybe it's less of a free market than you expected, as we also discussed, but because it is a market setup, really consumer choice, you know, drives what is happening in the market. And I think you've seen that consumer choice of some of these traditionally oil and gas consumers start to be more renewable friendly in the energy they're procuring to kind of serve their businesses.
So now let's talk about a hot topic for battery folks,
okay,
which is, of course, ancillary services, sure, because batteries take part in a lot of ancillary services.
Okay.
And there's been quite a lot of change recently in ERCOT. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Could you do a quick whistle-stop tour, like an overview of what's happening with ancillary services in ERCOT? So we've got old ones and new ones.
Okay.
And hold on, I'm answering your question for you.
No, you're telling me about ancillary services in ERCOT.
You're answering the question. Could you just give us a quick overview of ancillary services?
Ancillary services.
Without talking about N-1s.
Okay, yes. So ancillary services, you know, we have a few. We have responsive reserve. We have regulation non-spin. And so probably in 2015, we being stakeholders and ERCOT, started looking at sort of modernizing the suite of ancillary services, because as you see the grid changing, you know, maybe more possibility for those operational issues, you want a suite of ancillary services that matches that. So ERCOT first had an initiative that was called FAST. It was Future Ancillary Service Task Force, I think. And so that FAST initiative, I believe, was very comprehensive and was accordingly going to be pretty costly to consumers. And so that ultimately failed. We kind of went back and refined that. And so we did this through an MPRR, a revision request to the ERCOT protocols. And we came up with one new ancillary service and then kind of one subset to responsive reserve, the FFR, the fast frequency reserve, and then this new service, ERCOT Contingency Reserve Service. So that was
ECRS.
ECRS. That was approved well pre-URI. So I think that got a little bit confused. So that was in the works. And then we had URI and there were some operational problems. And then we were looking post-URI and we were looking at the solar ramp that was happening every day. And so we kind of tried to speed up ECRS and also make it this ramping product. And so we added the ECRS service last June, I believe. There has been a lot of scrutiny around the cost of it, and not just the cost of the service, but when you are kind of holding units out in reserve to be in that service, you are also making the cost of energy go up. And so there's been a lot of scrutiny around that.
Can we just talk about that for a second?
Yeah, of course.
What does that mean?
Scrutiny?
Yeah, we don't do scrutiny.
What do you do in the UK?
No, I'm only joking. It's we get scrutinized.
You have an actual pint glass.
Another 16-ounce nonsense. So I understand the cost of the service in a dollar per hour term, dollar per megawatt per hour term.
Yep.
But you're talking about a second order effect there, which is by holding the service, something else happens. What exactly does that mean?
So if you have, the resources that were bid into this service, if they were not bidding into this service, they would be in energy. And so in addition to the cost of the service, you are pulling resources out. And so on the energy bucket, you are tightening the supply. And then that just goes back kind of to basic economics, right? If you have the same amount of demand, but less supply, the price is going to go up. That's what I love about ERCOT. I think it is still a market to where if you just remember supply, demand equals price, I think you can get like 80% of the way.
So you're solving a problem over, it's like whack-a-mole. You're solving a problem over here, but then if that resources at a node, which is doing a good job of, you know, keeping normal prices, the mole comes up over here.
Yes, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you do you are now tinkering with the market, but you do want prices to reflect the situation you're in. So if you are saying when we really need this service, ECRS, is when we really need supply, you do want prices when you're in times of scarcity, you do want prices to reflect that, because what you're doing with prices in ERCOT is not just telling resources, we need you online right now because it's scarce, but what you have to do with that price is also give them enough money so that they can build in the future. And that's that resource adequacy conversation. Because we have an energy market and not a capacity market, you need that price to say we need you now, but also we are going to need you in the future. So you need to build to have enough to meet the situations.
Two more questions to come, but one more thing. What are the hot potatoes in policy at the moment? What's Jupiter Power really excited about or nervous about or fighting for? Or, you know, what are you guys discussing up in Jupiter Power headquarters? What are you guys discussing from a policy perspective?
Outside of Texas, we are looking at, you know, incentives to have more storage, right? A lot of, you know, state incentive programs and what's the best way to structure those. That becomes a hot potato kind of amongst storage companies. So I think in other states, it's looking at best ways to have incentives. Is that straight procurement? Is that some kind of credit mechanism? Is it a number of megawatts? Do you need them in a certain location with certain characteristics? So it's sort of incentivizing it in other states. In ERCOT, you know, I think we spoke about the big one. I think it's ancillary services. The participation in ancillary services, and particularly how ERCOT is going to procure those. If there's any rules that change to how storage or how other resources can provide ancillary services, I know we're also looking at implementing another new ancillary service. As we started to get into, there's been a lot of scrutiny around the cost of ECRS. So is that going to change? I think those are kind of the big policy items. You know, we're very curious to see what happens with the performance credit mechanism. I think that's something on our mind. I think storage is certainly a big player in ERCOT now, but it's sort of a new entrant. So I think a lot of the policy issues are still some things around making sure that there's technology neutral policy in place, not because people are trying to be not technology neutral, but just because some of these protocols or policies were written before storage was contemplated. So just kind of this new market entrance stuff, there's some of that still.
Square peg, round hole kind of stuff.
Some of that kind of stuff. You know, there's some metering things we've had to dig into just because storage is a load and a generator. So it's just, you know, more difficult and challenging to have some of these metering setups that a traditional generator might.
There's not a great deal of co-located storage in Texas compared to, say, California.
Yeah.
And I know some of that is policy driven. What do you think about that going forward? Do you think that's going to change?
I don't know. You know, I don't know if it's policy driven. Maybe because the setup of the market would be policy driven. I would say what you can see in storage is like a very good microcosm of the energy only market, right? Because the energy only market, you want price signals to tell you when generation and supply should match and how they should match. And because storage can be both a load and a generator, it does exactly that, right? So when we look at siting in ERCOT, it's where, you know, sometimes there's an excess of supply, so maybe more wind that we would charge on. But in the same place, there's sometimes an excess of demand, so we are needed. And so I think standalone storage is really well suited for that. Before the IRA, co-located storage, in order to get the ITC, you had to charge a certain amount from the
ITC
solar.
ITC being?
Investment tax credit. So you could get a tax credit for co-located storage, but not standalone storage pre-IRA, which I should know the acronym for. But
Inflation
Reduction Act.
And these tax credits are essentially subsidies, aren't they?
They're essentially subsidies.
But kind of called something different.
So yes, so pre 2 years ago, you could get a subsidy for co-located solar and storage, but not for standalone storage. And so, but in order to do so, you would have to charge from that solar, meaning you couldn't really take advantage of the ERCOT market the way standalone could, right? Or you couldn't be the same benefit either, you know, to put it another way, because you wouldn't be charging when there was excess wind or excess renewables just on the grid. You would be charging from your directly co-located solar. So really what you're doing was just having kind of a solar resource with maybe an extra hour or two of storage after the sun sets.
I never really thought about that. Actually, the investment tax credit, because it forces you to charge behind the meter,
yes,
actually prevents you from being available to provide
what is needed.
What is actually needed for the grid.
Mm-hmm. And so I think ERCOT was a better model for standalone and probably still is. You know, that ITC is available now.
I've had the aha moment in my brain.
I tell you something.
All right. So now the two final questions that we always have. Number one, is there anything you want to plug? So is there anything that you guys are doing, which is awesome, or a big announcement, or you want to get out to the battery community? This is your chance. And then the second question is about what's your contrarian view? And I know you've got a few of those.
I have a few of those. What I would like to plug is we do have a project that we have in construction in Houston, or however we decided to pronounce it. It is a 400 megawatt hour project. And so we are very excited about that. That is 400 megawatt hours of, you know, firm dispatchable power in Texas, and not only in Texas, but in a load center where people need it. We think that is kind of innovative and new, not just in Texas, but anywhere. I don't think there's that size storage in a city probably anywhere. You know, 200 megawatts, 400 megawatt hours is a very sizable project. That's what you used to see, you know, the gas turbines at when more of those were being built near load. So far in ERCOT, you've seen more storage in West Texas where there is congestion due to transmission congestion. This is sort of, you know, same theory, but applied a different way. It's congestion due to load. So we're very excited about this project. And we think, you know, it answers some of the political calls, right? It's firm dispatchable power in Houston.
Where you need it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we heard it here first. Thanks for sharing that. And the last one is, what's your contrarian view?
I thought a lot about this. So as a policy person, I don't know. I don't think this is, you know, maybe the company point of view. I've been a policy person most of my career. I don't think I have the distaste or discomfort for regulatory uncertainty that other people do, or maybe I see it differently. I think we talked about it a lot on this podcast, right? My idea of every conversation is kind of cyclical, and I don't think I would have ever expect, you know, put the grid away, we're done, set it and forget it. And so I would expect conversations to always be ongoing. I don't think I would ever expect, like, this is it, this is certainty for the future forever, because I don't know that that's always appropriate. And I do think that, you know, the beauty of the energy-only market is there are cycles, right? And there are people who do better and worse. And it's kind of, you know, it's a free market business mindset. And I think that you have to have that, especially when, you know, you're dependent on all sorts of business inputs, right?
So the contrarian view is...
I'm okay with regulatory uncertainty. That's not a good contrarian view.
Is that your contrarian view?
What?
That's not contrarian for the job you do.
I think everybody always wants regulatory certainty.
That's like me saying, I like software businesses. Any more contrarian views? You told me you thought a lot about this.
I did think a lot about this.
That's what you came up with.
What's your contrarian view? We're workshopping now.
I have lots of contrarian views, but no one ever asked me them on the podcast. Actually, contrary to what you've been saying throughout this whole podcast, mm-hmm. and every time we've met, one of the contrarian views I've had is I don't know whether this is contrarian or not. I'm still trying to figure it out, and I'm still, as I explained to you before, I'm still trying to figure out all the different camps and all that with ERCOT, because it seems like, as I said to you, if you go on Twitter, ERCOT Twitter is, or energy Twitter can be quite polarizing.
It can be.
But what I'm finding is real life is way less polarizing. When you go to events or happy hours or whatever, you feel like, it just feels like everybody's, it's very different to what you think on Twitter. That's not a contrarian view. But my contrarian view is, I think that Bitcoin miners can be a huge value add to the system and to the state. And I think that's quite contrarian, because a lot of battery folks are very, there seems to be like a battery versus Bitcoin mine argument happening. No?
You think so?
I don't know. I just judged that by your, I have heard that, but then also your face when I said it.
I don't think there's a battery versus, not, I wouldn't say battery specific.
No, just a.
I think that there has been some skepticism around Bitcoin. I think there's a number of different issues with it that people don't like, right? Or that people have a hard time with. You know, I think for a wires company, it's a new technical challenge, right? For a Bitcoin mine, you just didn't have a customer saying, I want to interconnect.
I want all the power, 200
megawatts,
time,
right?
Yeah.
And it's not even the amount of power. It's just first the wires infrastructure to interconnect that amount of power, even before you're actually consuming it. That just didn't happen before, right? You know, like your Sam's Club, or, you know, when you're talking about your industrials, a few were 100 or 2 megawatts, but some of these Bitcoin mines come and they want to interconnect a gigawatt or 2 gigawatts. And so I think the interconnection infrastructure, I think those folks weren't prepared for it. And then there's a lot of issues with that. You know, when we spoke briefly about 4CP. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a Bitcoin mine and you can fully avoid 4CP, so you can shut down totally during those hours, whereas we discussed, you know, you and me with babies at home can't turn our house off, the hospitals can't turn off,
Disney off,
right? And thus, because they can do so, they're not paying those transmission costs. I think there's a lot of scrutiny around, you know, what they would say is non-native load, right? That load doesn't need to be in the area. I don't think there's battery specific.
But the reason why I said that is because we had an awesome episode with a Bitcoin mine owner on a few weeks ago. Yeah, the reason why I had
Jamie.
It, we had Jamie on.
Jamie's great.
Recently, totally. I mean, they're out in West Texas, which is a little bit different, actually. I think there is a locational element to this.
A locational element, but I think it could be very complementary to the batteries that are there, right? I think that could be very complementary.
Caitlin, I want to say a massive thank you for coming on the podcast. Anything we talked about, I can't remember, but we're going to put some links in the show notes if that's worth doing.
Should we do a big diagram?
We'll do a diagram. We'll put that in the show notes. And if you want to find out more about Caitlin or Jupiter Power, do check out the links below. And see you next time. Thank you, Caitlin.
All right. Thank you.